Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guests today are Jonathan Haskell, Professor of Economics at the Imperial College London, and Stian Westlake, Senior Fellow at NESTA, the National Innovation Foundation, and Policy Advisor to Minister of State for Universities, Science, Research and Innovation. They're also the authors of a new book, Capitalism Without Capital, The Rise of the Intangible Economy, and that's going to be the subject of our discussion today. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. We'll start
off with, I suppose, a basic question, which is, why this book and why now? Jonathan.
Our book stands and falls essentially upon what we think is a fact, which is that over the last 30-odd years, the nature of investment that firms undertake has changed in a rather important way. It used to be that most firm investment was concentrated in tangible assets, that's to say buildings, vehicles, plant and equipment, all very familiar. What's happened is investment has changed, and now it's much more concentrated in intangible assets, assets that you can't, you know, touch and feel in the way that you can do with, you know, buildings and vehicles and all that kind of thing. So what do I mean by intangible assets? Things like R&D, things like design, things like business processes, marketing, reputation, those kinds of things. And that change of investment, we think, has got all sorts of interesting consequences.
And is this pattern and trend a good thing, Stian? You know, is this something we should be encouraged, we should be celebrating?
Well, one of the things that becomes clear is that this is a very long-term phenomenon. Mm. So perhaps it's something that's deeply structural and that whether we like it or not, there's not much we can do about it. So we look back at the data, and as Jonathan said, this is a phenomenon that we've seen very strongly in the last 30 years. But interestingly, some of the research in the US, the work of people like Carol Corrado, have taken that time series back even further. And it turns out that this phenomenon predates the semiconductor, it predates the most of what we think of as modern technology, and it goes right back through the 20th century. So it's one of these very much kind of long durée phenomena that for us is kind of a pretty established fact in the economy. So the question is not so much how can we stop this, but how can we make sure that our countries and cities and people thrive in an economy where intangibles are becoming more important.
And this is an economy that spans, it's not just a UK story, it's not just a US story, it's a global story, is that right?
And I think it's not just a high technology story
right.
as well.
Yeah.
So people have rightly said, oh, think about, you know, LinkedIn and companies like that, their companies which just pure intangible businesses. So one of the things we try to do in the book is we try to point out that you actually see intangibles, well, you see them everywhere.
Yeah.
Once you've written a book on intangibles, of course, you see them
everywhere.
I mean, if I could just give a quick example.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, one of the examples I rather like is, you know, if you've ever been on a low-cost airline or indeed any kind of airline, you'd be very familiar with the kind of tangible assets that the airline has. Mm. You walk onto the plane, you walk through a big, you know, tunnel, you know, a big piece of moving equipment, and that gets you onto the plane. The oil tanker that fills up the plane is a vehicle and all that kind of thing. So there's lots of tangible assets that you see literally when you get onto that plane.
Yeah.
And if you went to the company accounts, you would see them in the company accounts. But if you think about all the intangible assets, especially in the low-cost airlines, they're the things that really make these low-cost airlines sing. So they are, for example, all the software which you use to book yourself on and check yourself in. Mm. They are the amazing kind of business processes, the way the airline have worked out to get you on really quickly and get you off really quickly as well and get the next people on, keeps the plane, you know, up in the air.
Yeah.
One of the other things in low-cost airlines is the rostering of the crew is very complicated. There are all sorts of, quite rightly, you know, safety regulations about how long crews are allowed to be on and off for, lots of part-time people working for them and all that kind of thing. All that stuff is very, very complicated.
Yeah.
And the well-run low-cost airlines do all that kind of thing as well. Those are all intangible types of attributes around the knowledge, the business processes, the software and the databases that these airlines have.
And so that's talking about a mix, in a sense, the mix of the tangible and the, because I think in the book you've got lots of examples, but and I've read elsewhere about the, you know, the Walmart and their adoption of technology to really drive the productivity of the firm, which is obviously a very tangible firm on the one hand, but
so one concept that we talked about in the book is the concept of innovation with an ER, which sounds like some incredibly cheesy marketing phrase, but it's actually something that medics talk about. So innervation, with sort of nerve in the middle, is about the process by which a body part, like your hand, is sort of interpenetrated by nerves.
Right.
It's the nerves in something.
Yeah.
And one way of looking at the tangible-intangible interplay is that once upon a time, you know, in a tangible, rich economy, there were a lot of physical assets, but actually there wasn't that much investment in the control and coordination of those assets.
Yes.
But an intangible economy, although, as Jonathan said, there are some intangible-only businesses, or low, but it also has businesses like budget airlines, which have some tangible assets, but which kind of have flowing through them these intangibles that control and make them more effective and market them in the way that kind of the nerves go through a piece of the human body and make it active.
Mm. And at the economy level, where does the UK sit in terms of intangibles and tangibles vis-a-vis the US and some of our other European cities? Where is it?
So the UK is a relatively high intangible investment country.
Yeah.
If you sort of look at, if you compare countries based on the work that Jonathan Carroll Corrado and others have done, the UK is pretty high, the US is very high, the Nordic countries, Scandinavia, tend to be high. The sort of Central European countries, or sort of Central Western European countries, slightly lower. Southern Europe, lower again. And one kind of interesting consequence of this, which we've written about before, is that it's long been held that the UK has an investment problem. So if you go back to kind of John Maynard Keynes on the Macmillan Committee in the 1930s, or Will Hutton writing State We're In the 1990s, one of the big stylized facts, stories they tell about the UK economy is the UK underinvests. And it's certainly true that the UK underinvests in physical capital. There's some evidence that the UK underinvests in R&D. But as far as we can tell, based on the work that people like the OECD have done comparing countries, if you add in all intangibles, that picture becomes much more mixed, because the UK tends to do well on intangibles.
Yes.
I think, you know, there's obviously more measurement that could be done before we can see that's a firm conclusion. But it certainly adds an interesting wrinkle to that story that we all think we know about the UK economy.
Yeah,
and if I can just say, just as a baseline figure, this maybe, this of course is in the book, but you know, since we're old friends, I'll tell you what I'll tell you what the figure is that essentially for every pound or euro or dollar of tangible investment, we think there's about £1.10 or euros or dollars of intangible investment. That's on average across all the developed countries.
Yes.
In the US, that would be, you know, $1.20. Likewise, in the UK, it's rather high. In Spain, it would be, you know, 50p. You know, it would be rather less. But that's essentially the takeaway figure.
And is there something to explain, for example, why it might be higher in the US, or why it might be slightly higher in the UK, Nordic countries, than maybe others? It's noticeable in the book that Germany is an outlier in a sense of more tangible than intangible. So is there a history to that?
There's a blend of things going on, of course. Part of it is that as technical progress makes tangible goods cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, machines and computers most notably, then they're less of a budget share, if you see what I mean. On the other hand, buildings are getting more and more expensive, especially in cities, as I'm sure we'll come to.
Yeah.
That's only part of the story. The other part of the story, of course, is that the industrial mix of these different countries varies a bit.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of services, other people have got a lot of manufacturing. So you then might say, well, are the services more intangible intensive, or the manufacturing more intangible intensive? But actually, it turns out that manufacturing is terribly intangible intensive. We think of it as being dominated by heavy machinery and all that kind of stuff as well. But it's actually the other way around. And if anything, the boundary is blurred between manufacturing and services. If you go to Rolls-Royce, they're doing design, they're doing R&D, they're doing, you know, all that sort of stuff, even though in manufacturing.
Yeah.
And then the last element, besides the overall trend and the sort of industry structure, is of course there are different forms of regulation which countries face. You know, some got tighter product market regulation, some got looser product market regulation. And what we discuss in the book is the correspondence of intangible investment with those types of regulatory frameworks.
Right. Yeah.
I guess one other interesting question is the relationship between finance and the particular financial architecture in the country,
yeah.
and the tangible and intangible
yeah.
mix.
Yeah.
So we have a chapter in the book where we talk about what intangibles mean for finance and how you finance intangible businesses. But one of the important facts, and we can sort of come to the characteristics of intangibles mm. later, one thing about intangibles is they tend to represent sunk costs
yeah.
for a firm. So, you know, if you buy a fleet of vans, a tangible asset, and your company goes out of business, your creditors can sell that fleet of vans and recoup some of their investment. If you have some designs or a relationship of network with your suppliers, that's worth much less to your creditors. Now, what that means is if you think about debt finance and equity finance, the two kind of main ways that
yep.
you can finance a business, debt finance is, all other things being equal, a less appropriate mm. way of financing an intangible intensive business. And if we think of a kind of economic history of finance, one of the things that's characterized some of the high tangible capital investment countries, sort of France or Germany, for example, is a financial architecture that has sort of state-backed banks, things like Crédit Foncier, these kind of big establishments that have been designed to build in the late 19th century a kind of tangible, rich industrial base. The UK obviously has not been characterised by that and has done much less of that. So there's kind of a sense that maybe there are some very long-term historical things that means that a tangible economy is more favoured by a continental model of banking.
That's an interesting one around the, and how that might continue to evolve over time. You know, the kind of interesting debates about, if you look at Germany and other places, is whether they're at a point in time, but actually their economy is evolving
yeah.
into something else.
And it's a really interesting question when we talk about the future of industrial
yeah.
development, because one thing that's often proposed in the UK political debate is, should we have a state investment
yeah.
bank?
Yeah.
And obviously a state investment bank covers a kind of multitude of different options.
Yeah.
But I think one thing you'd say is if you take a state bank in a very classical sense, a kind of organisation that provides cheap debt for companies, then perhaps that model, at least, is less appropriate the more intangible the economy becomes.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, there still may very well be a role for public equity finance or other kinds of products, but it kind of, again, lends another flavour to that debate about should we have a national investment bank.
No, quite. In the book, you've got a brilliant chapter which looks at the sort of measurement challenges, trying to get a handle on what intangible is, and the fantastic work that's been done over the recent past to try and get a better handle on that. I suppose my question is more, if we assume, which rightly or wrongly, we measure what matters, and what matters is, you know, what we measure.
Mm.
If we can't get a handle on this, are we undervaluing the role of intangibles, not in a narrow sense of, you know, in the national accounts, but as a social element, as a kind of economic element? If we can't really see it or feel it, because I think you touch on this towards the end, and we'll come to that, on the policy challenges, you have to have the sort of the reason, the call to action in order to do something about it. I don't know, you know, whether all of that is all rolled up.
Yeah, I don't know whether this, I mean, it's very kind of you to say that you enjoyed the chapter, because to some people the measurement issue is, you know,
yeah, well,
somewhat sleep-inducing.
It's telling you something about me, that is, to be honest.
But it
there
is,
we are.
But when you say a brilliant chapter, there are many brilliant
No, there are. I didn't say the only.
I just want to make that.
Absolutely right.
I think the thing about a couple of things about the measurement
yeah.
issues. The reason why we've called the book Capitalism Without Capital
yeah.
is precisely because of this measurement issue,
yeah.
which is to say, many national accountants and certainly almost all company accountants are very, very reluctant to measure this stuff. They don't quite know how to value R&D and branding
yeah.
and all that sort of stuff. Now, as it turns out, the situation is somewhat worse than that, actually, which is, you might say, well, if you're not going to measure it, then just put a value of nothing on it and then just stick at that. But actually, especially in company accounts, if I, for example, buy another company which has got lots of R&D, I am allowed to put the value of the R&D in some way on my balance sheet.
Yeah.
If, on the other hand, I do some internal R&D, I've got a whole big lab doing R&D, I'm not allowed to put the value
yeah.
of the R&D on the balance sheet. So it's actually sort of almost worse than not counting it at all. So I think that's one observation. In other
yes.
words, it's asymmetric. Second observation is, it is quite true that by counting it and giving it a figure zero, you're giving it a very precise figure.
Yeah.
But you're giving it a figure zero. And we think, therefore, all things considered, you probably ought to have a stab at all this stuff.
Yeah.
And what most of the book essentially is it's an attempt to sort of survey the last kind of 15, 20 years of research.
Mm.
That, people have done, sponsored by Nesta, sponsored by the OECD, other organisations, ESRC, things like that. We try to kind of bring together all that research has been done and ask the question, suppose you did try to measure this stuff. Suppose you didn't just ascribe zero or use this rather asymmetric kind of procedure. Suppose you really did try to measure this stuff. What would the economy look like?
Yeah.
And that's really what a book tries to do.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting when we talk about company accountants here, because if you take the national accountants who try and measure GDP, broadly speaking, they've got a task of trying to be roughly right. And that's why there have been kind of efforts to bring intangibles like artistic originals and software and R&D into the national accounts. Now, the incentives on company accountants, on financial accountants, are slightly different in that they operate by the principle of prudence, and kind of the greatest sin for a company accountant, or one of the greatest sins, is to stick a bunch of things on the balance sheet that turn out in some predictable way to have been worthless. So there's a kind of the incentives are different on the downside to on the upside. There is some really interesting work by accountants being done to try and measure this, though. So I know the Ernst & Young in London, for example, are trying to develop ways of putting the value of intangible in the notes of the accounts, if not in the balance sheet. And obviously, if you're an equity analyst, the kind of the people who pour through company accounts to try and work out how to make investment decisions, if you're an investment analyst in an intangible-rich business, of course, they've been trying to work this stuff out privately for a very long time. And certainly one thing that we conclude in the book is actually really good equity analysis. People spending more time thinking about this it's a good way of making money if you want to make money by trading the stock, because we think there are undervalued assets out there. But it's also good for the economy as a whole, because the more analysis goes into this kind of thing, the more public markets will give credit to these investments.
And one of the things that we do in the book is we talk precisely about what these equity analysts do. That is to say, people who see the lack of measurement, they don't just sort of give up. They try, as Steve was just saying, to try to kind of backfill it somehow or other.
Yeah.
And Brooke Lev, who's an accounting professor at NYU, has got this fantastic study where he's got phone records of equity analysts' discussions with a selected group of companies.
Right.
And he does a kind of text search, as it were, on the phone records. Yeah. That's not quite right. It's like an audio kind of search, whatever, to find out what kind of things they ask about. And, of course, what do they ask about? They ask about precisely the stuff that isn't in the accounts.
Yeah.
Like, for example, how big is the network? You know, what is the reputation? What measures do you have of returning? What fraction of customers are returning customers? You know, what are the relationships, ongoing relationships with your suppliers? And there's all those very intangible things. That's exactly, if they're a zero, that's exactly what informed people are actually trying to
acquire themselves. I mean, and one of the things you always hear if you talk to anybody in the sort of venture capital industry that are trying to make investments in the firms, they say, quality of the management. Can we trust these people? You know, can we work with these people?
Yeah.
You know, that's in the book, but you know, that's a sort of separate.
And there's a lovely study by an academic at London Business School called Alex Edmonds that looked at whether quality of management was accurately reflected in the price of companies. And he did a very clever thing, which he took one of these very well-known surveys of which are the best companies to work for. You know, totally public information, and as any financial economist say, public information should be priced into the stock. You shouldn't be able to make money by trading on well-known public information. And he sort of said, do companies that have a reputation in these kind of surveys for being brilliant employers, do they outperform the stock market? Is there value that isn't being taken into account in the short term by traders? And he found very clearly that there was. So this is a great example of something where actually public equity markets, unless they do their analysis, don't fully reflect the value of those intangibles.
No, that's a very good point. Very good point. Let's explore a little bit more around, because I think the arguments you make in the book around the emergence and the growth of intangible aspects of the economy is in part a continuation of previous trends, but also represents something, you know, something different. It's not just that continuation. There's a kind of rupture between previous and current and future. And what I thought was excellent in the way that you did it was you used the four S's to try and express that and illustrate both the discontinuity and then some of the issues. So just tell us what the four S's are, and then we'll kind of get into a conversation, because I think particularly for two of them, you may say, or for two of them, I think, they have a particular relevance and a connection to our area, which is cities and the networks that, you know, cities represent. But what are the four S's?
So the four S's are these kind of general economic characteristics that intangible investments have, which is why we think an intangible economy is different. And the first S is scalability.
Yep.
And that basically means that if you have an intangible asset, you can often use it again and again without it being depleted. Mm. Whereas tangible assets, if you want to do more business, you need to buy more. So if you're a taxi company like Addison Lee and you want to do more business, you need to buy or lease more taxis. If you're Uber and you have an algorithm, that algorithm can be used across almost any amount of business. Mm. So scalability is the first one. The second one I alluded to briefly before is sunkenness, which is the idea that if you invest in an intangible compared to a tangible, it's much harder to sell that, to dispose of it to someone else, particularly if the business fails. So a story we like to tell is Monarch Airlines, who sadly went out of business a while ago. Monarch Airlines owned some tangibles, they owned some planes, and they owned some intangibles. Now, the planes were immediately recycled as soon as the company stopped trading to lessors, and you know they're now in storage and flying again and so forth. But they had very valuable intangible in the form of their landing rights, which are hugely valuable. They're intangible, you can't touch or feel them. And it turned out that those took months and months to even work out whether Monarch owned them, let alone to dispose of them. And we see this again and again. Ideas are kind of hard to sell. The third intangible, and this is going to start getting relevant to cities and urban planning, is spillovers.
Yeah.
And the idea of spillovers is if you make an intangible investment, sometimes your firm, may get the benefit of that investment, but equally, ideas are kind of hard to box in, so someone else may share in that benefit, or in fact, another company may make all the money from it entirely. So we talk about stories like the invention of the CT scanner, a hugely important medical breakthrough, pioneered by EMI, the British company, later known as a kind of record label.
Yeah.
EMI made virtually no money out of the CT scanner. All the money was made by their competitors, GE and Siemens, and we hear that story again and again, because knowledge tends to spill over. And then the fourth S is synergies, because it turns out that these intangibles are unusually good, unusually valuable when you put them together with other intangibles. Ideas, for example, are really good when you put them together with other ideas. And it was Schumpeter who talked about one sort of vision of innovation as combining things together. This is really what we see with intangibles, that when you bring them together, they're particularly important.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the four S's, and the reason we think they're important is because this change to intangible assets, because intangible assets have these different properties, we think this helps explain why things are changing in the economy.
John, did you want to add anything to that? I mean, that covers it, because one of the, from our point of view, what's quite interesting looking at your data as to the rise of intangibles, and particularly if you think, you know, I know this was happening beforehand, but you can see a noticeable increase through, once we get into the 90s, that kind of coincides, not only, well, certainly in the UK, possibly in the US as well, that kind of coincides with the return of urbanism, right?
That's very interesting.
You know, in a sense, we've seen population and firms and jobs kind of coming back to cities, particularly some of our bigger cities, but not exclusively. London is an example of this, but Manchester would tell you something different, something similar as well. So there's, you know, this kind of interest in, as intangibles become more important, our cities are also on that, you know, riding that cusp. And that's why I think there's an interesting combination there between urbanism as a process and intangible growth as a process. And, you know, which is driving which, but they're definitely working together in some shape or form.
I think the other development, which lots of people talked about at the time, is the creative economy.
Yeah.
So lots of people have sort of struggled with the creative economy.
Yeah.
Maybe this would add a little bit of colour to the S's that Stephen was just talking about. People kind of struggle with describing the creative economy. It's not manufacturing, so the manufacturing people don't like it, and it's a bit too lightweight, and the people don't quite know how to count it, and all that sort of stuff. But if you put an intangible sort of hat on and view it, you know, that way, then it all becomes, I think, much clearer.
Yeah.
So I always ask my students, I teach at Imperial College, I always ask my students to name Britain's most famous innovation. And some of them think about, you know, Concorde, and other than try to think about, I don't know, you know, something Monty Python or something like that, some kind of BBC invention or anything. And the answer, of course, is absolutely obvious once you sort of think about it, because it's an innovation which, you know, even the remotest you know, tribes in Africa have heard about, and that is Harry Potter. And if you ask the question kind of, what is Harry Potter, well, in some sense, it's a deeply intangible asset.
Yeah.
That is to say, although it's printed on a piece of paper, the books were, it's the idea and the notion and all of that.
Yeah.
So how does that all come into, you know, what Stephen was just talking about? If you think about what the Harry Potter franchise has now become,
yeah,
it's become this synergy of a bundle of intangible assets. So it's not only, you know, the fantastic J.K. Rowling script, it's the amazing computer software, you know, that does all the tremendous stuff in the movies,
yeah,
and then it's the set design, giving it that extraordinary kind of slightly gothic kind of look and feel.
Yeah.
Then it's all the marketing and everything that's done, and the branding and all that sort of stuff. Mm. And again, you know, people sort of say, well, what on earth is going on? Well, to us, there are just a bundle of these intangible assets, the intangible asset of the creative idea of the book itself, the design, another intangible asset, the software, another intangible asset, the marketing reputation, another intangible asset. Once you bundle those together, the synergies that they produce are going to be a source of great reward.
Yeah.
And of course, if you then ask the question, where geographically are those synergies, so I think I'm trying to come to your question,
yeah,
where geographically are those synergies going to occur? The truth is, they're not going to happen in rural locations.
No.
They're probably going to happen in urban locations.
Yep.
So we think that that's part of the reason why the rise in the creative economy and the rise in cities as well have got this common factor behind them, namely the growth of the intangibles and the economic property of synergies
behind
the intangibles.
Well, I think, you know, you touch on it implicitly and explicitly, you know, this because of the bundling of these different characteristics and the interplay between them and the reinforcement, you get into these sort of cycles where they're in existence, you see quite prosperous firms, quite prosperous places more generally, where you don't see these characteristics of, you know, and therefore these firms, you know, we see the reverse, don't we?
That's right, that's very true.
Yeah, and I think that is I'm interested in your kind of reflections on that. I mean, it's so often we have conversations with policymakers as you do, and it's, you know, economic activity is not equally or randomly distributed across space, you know, and you have to understand why that is. You may wish it to be evenly and randomly distributed, but it isn't. And you're going against quite significant trends and forces if you're trying to push that other places.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I guess if you believe that these spillovers and these synergies are making cities more important, one conclusion you draw from that is the benefits of bring lots of people together in one place, you know, what economists love to call agglomeration effect, that those are going to grow over time.
Yeah.
Now, if that's the case, if agglomeration effects are going to grow over time, that has some pretty important messages for public policy. Mm. On the one hand, you know, in the UK and in other places, we are rightly concerned about what to do about left behind places, as you say.
Yep.
Some places are not benefiting from this. But it makes things harder because it means there's the kind of Matthew effect to those that have more will be given.
Yep.
So it potentially means that someone like Manchester has a bright future, someone like Liverpool has a bright future, but it puts someone like Blackpool in a harder position if it's not big enough to achieve those agglomeration effects.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of first tough question about what do you do there. I guess another question, which perhaps is UK specific, obviously a kind of bugbear of many economists, is the UK planning system.
Indeed.
And to the extent that the UK planning system constrains the growth of some of these places with agglomeration effects, you would expect, I don't think it's right to say UK planning system is a bad thing, because, you know, it's done a great job at preventing urban sprawl, which is something that's very popular with a lot of people in our democracy.
Yeah.
But one way of looking at it is to say that in an economy that's becoming more intangible, the cost of that planning system to the economy, to wages and to productivity, will increase year by year.
Absolutely.
So if we want to do it, that's fine, but it'll cost us more and more each year.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, again, I think that appreciation of the increasing negative costs of constraining more popular areas now in the modern economy, you know, increases day on, you know, year on year. I was interested in your thinking. I go back to this question and issue about, you know, the spillovers question. It kind of relates to the synergies one. You know, individual firms, may underinvest because they can't capture sufficiently the spillovers themselves, you know, social gains outweigh private gains, which, on the one hand, which is a kind of possibly negative from the firm point of view. But with my city's lens on, it's kind of thinking about whether, if we think about spillovers at the spatial scale of a city, do we begin to understand how that might work? And does that get us towards, you know, policy? Because we've seen, we've had an industrial strategy, you know, recently released, which has kind of had this dual approach of firm orientation, place orientation. I mean, there's mission stuff in it as well. But so I think there's an, I'd just be interested in your thoughts around, you know, around that sort of where we are on that stuff.
So I think part of the answer to that hinges on what type of spillovers you think are occurring.
Yeah.
So I notice in this room, we're sitting in the Glaser room here. Glaser, famous Harvard economist, has got some sort of spillovers named after him. Yeah. And they are typically, as your listeners might know, the kind of spillovers that take place within an industry. Mm. So if we have, you know, the car industry, we think that within the industry, other car people might learn from other car people up and down the car supply chain. Mm. People might learn in that way. Mm. And then next door to us in the room where we're not recording is the Jacobs room. And of course, Jacobs, you know, famous urban researcher from the 1960s, had in her mind these spillovers that took place across different industries.
Yeah.
Essentially, she thought that these were being driven by the diversity of the different industries. So I think behind your question is, if we could figure out which of these types of spillovers are occurring, then we can start maybe having a little bit more certainty about what's going on with policy and what the right policy is.
I think that's very true. I think the other dimension, the other kind of dilemma potentially for policymakers that these spillovers cause is, well, on the one hand, we've just said we want lots of people to live together in cities. We want agglomeration effects. And one of the things that that means is we've got to build houses for them to live
Indeed.
In. On the other hand, if you liberalise the rules on planning that allow people to build houses, one of the things that we've seen happens is people take what is seen as less economically valuable space, or less privately valuable space, like cultural venues, and they turn into flats.
Indeed.
And, the campaigning work of people like Ben Walters, who campaigns to protect LGBT venues in London, I think is kind of great example of showing what can be lost if we develop with absolutely kind of no attention to creating spaces for the spillovers. So kind of one extreme, you have a city, I don't know if this is entirely fair, but a city a bit like Oxford, which is stunning, a great place for people to interact, but it's rather hard to build things.
It is indeed.
And at the other extent, you have a city like perhaps Houston, or certainly what Houston used to be like, where there's kind of no rules. You can build anything you like, but it's sprawl and, you know, no two people ever cross paths because they're always driving in a sort of suburban space. So I guess the question is, how do you make sure you can build enough that you can agglomerate, but at the same time that you can create third spaces where people can come together? And I guess the kind of the one word answer to that is urbanism.
Well, not quite. And I mean, I'm interested in your thoughts about how we might resolve or at least think about how we might deal with those sort of trade-offs in the policy space. But I was struck reading the book. When you thought about those sorts of policy interventions, in many instances similar to us, you know, we would say, if you're thinking about Oxford or Cambridge or London or even places like Bristol, all very expensive cities to live in, you know, the economic development policy for them is actually to build more housing. You know, it's not a kind of classic economic development type business support program or an innovation program, which you would classically put in an economic development pot. If we want to get more stuff going on in Cambridge or elsewhere, or London even, you know, we need to build more housing so in a sense people can come in, prices can be managed a little bit more effectively. I think that, you know, and that in itself I thought was, you know, was an interesting insight, because often that's missed as part of the response and the requirements.
It's very true. And if we sort of ask ourselves kind of pub quiz question, what was the most successful industrial policy of the 1980s, a decade not much associated with industrial policy, I'd put in a strong case for Canary Wharf.
Absolutely.
And Canary Wharf is obviously, you know, there was a lot of thinking, but fundamentally it was about saying, let's take a cluster, a very intangible intensive cluster, and let's build a big chunk of more office space and more housing kind of somewhat adjacent to it so it can grow. And I suppose that's a kind of an interesting question for somewhere like Oxford and Cambridge. if you could build the equivalent of kind of Edinburgh Newtown,
yeah,
Oxford yeah. Newtown or Cambridge Newtown, might that actually be a very effective way of doing R&D policy without actually
doing R&D policy? Yeah, yeah, quite right.
So I think Brookings are very interesting on all this. Brookings Institute in the US, but Bruce Katz and co-authors have been looking at all of this, as you know, your listeners may well be familiar with.
Yeah.
And I think they've got this interesting notion that, you know, not only do you need the physical assets in cities and the business presence and also, but you need these networking assets,
as
Stephen was just saying, because these are the areas where, you know, you get these synergies and you get these spillovers, which, you know, we talk about in the book. That said, my reading of those types of studies is it's very, very hard.
It's very hard.
It's quite difficult to draw some very generalised business lessons. And if you read, as I say, we're in the Glazer room, if you read Ernst Glazer's book on the triumph of the city, I think his book, you know, reflects that.
Yeah, it does.
Which is that, contrary to what people think, you know, what he's not saying is, let's knock the whole place down and build a whole bunch of skyscrapers and, you know, all that. And he's not saying that at all, actually. He talks about the protection of these spaces. But these trade-offs are very, very delicate.
No, they do. And, you know, I think you touch on it. And I think probably some of the most interesting work I've seen recently on the value of institutions and networks to try and facilitate that is some of the work that Mike Stauper and Tom Kemeny have been doing. And they took a nice study of San Francisco and Los Angeles, took it all the way back to 1970, and actually said, if you look at those two cities in 1970 on a range of metrics that we would be interested in, your income, et cetera, they were pretty much in a similar space. You know, they were reasonably, you know, same sort of wage levels, et cetera, et cetera. And then they kind of look forward, play forward on these their trajectories. And what you've seen over time is that San Francisco is now crudely in a very, is in a different development club to Los Angeles. They're both prosperous, but you know, San Francisco is noticeably, demonstrably more prosperous than Los Angeles. And they unpick, you know, the various reasons why that might be. But one of the interesting things that they explore and actually feel confident in stating is that the quality of the networks in those two cities was quite different. And in Los Angeles, a lot of the networks, they weren't that many networks, they weren't embedded, they didn't draw in lots of different institutions, but they were also mainly about, until relatively recently, defending older assets like the port.
Interesting.
So, you know, all the resource was thinking about that rather than the future, as it were. Whereas in San Francisco, firstly, more institutions, more networks, more multivariate stuff going on, plus less wedded to the past and trying as best he can to have some sense of what's going to be. It's a great piece of work, but it raises this issue about, you know, that it's not only the assets, but how the assets are ultimately used and envisaged, which is really
important. That's very interesting. And it reminds me of, I remember reading some of Charlie Leadbeater's work on Youngstown, Ohio, and again, a really densely networked steel town in the early 20th century, which used its networks kind of defensively rather than to kind of, that's a very interesting dimension which we should think more about.
Because you touch on it in the book around, you know, thinking about the and looking at some of the questions in relation to Brexit voting patterns, and then openness and closeness to the, you know, to the future and to society and to, you know, new ideas, which, you know, I think the other work has shown that there, you know, there is something in that, isn't it? Kind of thinking about that.
Well, I think I think it's very true, and I guess from our point of view, this sort of openness to experience idea. We know that openness to experience is a kind of measurable psychological trait. Some people have more of it, some people have less of it, and we know that it was somewhat associated with people's decision to have a vote in the EU referendum. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of our reflections, we were writing this book over the period when the referendum is being held, so this is kind of very salient to us.
Yeah, quite.
But we, at that time, and kind of still, there was this kind of very binary debate going on where people were saying, did this kind of, this decision to vote for Brexit, did it stem from economic reasons or did it stem from cultural reasons? Was it a kind of cultural dislike for the liberal elite, or was it kind of places that have been left behind by kind of late capitalism or whatever? And I think our take on that would be, well, if you believe that some of these attitudes, like openness to experience, are related to your ability to thrive in an economy with synergies and spillovers, and your decision to potentially leave a left behind place and move to London or move to Bristol or wherever, then perhaps the answer is it's both causes. Perhaps the answer is that the economic and the cultural causes cross-fertilise and explain why populism in a general sense is kind of such an issue now compared to, you know, the 1990s or the 80s
yeah,
and 70s.
Yeah, I think that's right. In terms of sort of policy responses, again, another thing I admired in the book was your, you know, was your honesty about, and by the way, if you're waiting for the one big thing that's going to revolutionise, you know, the situation or make, you know, make it all work handsomely and wonderfully for the benefit of everyone, you're going to be disappointed.
No, well, that's in our next book.
Right. You know, but I think, you know, so there was, you know, there isn't one answer. You know, this stuff is difficult. The trade-offs are, you know, are non-trivial. The timescales will be long. You know, as somebody who works in that policy space, I always get asked that question. So, you know, what does this place need to do to turn itself around? You know, what's the one thing? And you think, here we go again. I'll take my hat off to the pair of you in terms of I admire your, you know, your honesty, but there isn't one thing, and it's really difficult, and it's going to take quite a while.
I mean, this is a difficult area. We were at an event yesterday, and David Willetts told a story which I'd forgotten, which is that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, this famous politician in the US, indeed, was asked, I believe, you know, in the 70s, how is it that you create a vibrant, growth-orientated cluster?
Yeah.
To which his answer is, build a university and wait 200 years. And indeed, as David Willetts pointed out, if you look at all the top-rated universities, they are indeed all 200 years old. So it actually turns out to be, as a piece of economic forecasting, since us economists are often not that good at forecasting, this is a fantastic piece of economic forecasting. But it does make these it does make predicting these policies really, really hard. I mean, essentially because, of course, what's wrong about that is it's not just a university, as we were just saying.
No.
The university correctly identifies the fact that you need these, you know, intangible knowledge spillovers, and the university is often a, you know, wellspring of those intangible spillovers. But as we were talking about earlier on, you need the infrastructure by which those spillovers will take place, and by the ways that people will interact.
A few years ago, I wrote an article called "Why Bright People Make Dull Policy Recommendations," and it was a complaint about reading.
I remember that.
Reading brilliant books that had a sort of policy recommendation chapter at the end that would always tend to go in one of two bad directions.
Yeah.
They either make very, very like close to market policy recommendations, which were kind of out of date 3 months after the book was written, or far too specific, or they would be these kind of wildly naive recommendations, like, you know, abolish the planning system, which kind of didn't actually recognise the constraints. So when the time came to write our policy recommendation, having kind of put myself out there, it was kind of very much squeaky bum time. this had better not fall into those traps. And so what we tried to do was to say, okay, we're not going to say this is the kind of panacea, but we're going to say, well, what are some dilemmas? Mm. What are some trade-offs that you have to operate in this new world that maybe might not be so obvious? And, you know, there are some clear trade-offs here. So, for example, we talked earlier about how this intangible economy increases inequality of various sorts, whether that's kind of inequality between left behind places and cities, or whether it's inequality between successful firms and laggard firms. So on the one hand, it increases inequality. On the other hand, because intangible assets are often quite flighty, you know, Amazon has a lot of intangible assets that are registered in quite different places from where Amazon's customers sit, because intangible assets aren't physical. It's quite hard to determine where they're based. That kind of makes it harder to tax an intangible economy. So on the one hand, you sort of say inequality is going up. On the other hand, if your tax base is getting kind of harder to tap into, then your traditional weapon of tackling inequality, which is to tax and redistribute, gets trickier. And now, obviously, there are kind of pragmatic ways you can try and address that, but it's a sort of a problem that will become more important as the economy gets more tangible.
I mean, several things, but on that policy, it would be interesting to get your thoughts on, because of its complex nature, are we inevitably in a sort of incremental, you know, moving slight, you know, step by step on different things, or is there a kind of big bang? I think that's quite, I was difficult to envisage that. Get your thoughts on that. Interested in your thoughts on whether we can imagine a reasonably coherent policy system that is kind of working for intangibles and tangibles, or do we need to think about them as being, you know, somewhat different or separate? And then my third sort of question, we'll come back to these in a second, is, you know, interested in your thoughts around the balance between, you know, national policy or national levers in relation to, you know, finance systems or whatever, or tax systems, and what can our, you know, what can our local leaders and what can our local places be doing to try, you know, to try and get more of, you know, of the intangible economy in whatever form that is. So I mean, kind of lots of questions in there, but I mean, just it's interesting, just your general reflections and thoughts on that.
So let me start with some maybe slightly more positive thoughts, having said that all very difficult one is in danger of being dull. It does seem to me that there are probably a couple of things where we could probably say this policy almost certainly is going to be a good idea in an intangible economy.
Right.
And they are around science policy and around finance, which we sort of touched on.
Yeah.
Which is to say the following, that if we've got, as I think we have, you know, a much more intangible economy, people working much more with ideas, one thing we do think we know from a large number of economic studies is that more intangible investment by the private sector responds very positively to intangible investment by the public sector.
Okay. Yeah.
And the most sort of studied area is public sector R&D, essentially. So that does seem to be an area where, you know, despite one's being cautious and all that kind of thing, I think there we can say there's quite a lot of evidence behind all of that. Mm. Now, of course, if you were to push us, you'd say, well, what are the exact mechanisms and where exactly should it go?
Yeah.
And then again, I think, again, we've got, you know, some things to sort of say about that. So, for example, what you don't want in science policy is an increase in science spending one minute and then a big cut the next minute and then an increase the following minute and all that kind of thing. So what you want is you want some political commitment or via either, you know, unanimity amongst political parties or some kind of mechanism, you know, some independent funding council or sort of something like that. And it does seem to me that this is all governments of all colours, actually. The last 10 years or so has seen some quite, you know, sort of stable, you know, commitments to science policy. As I say, that was true David Sainsbury under the Labour government, Vince Cable, who's been on this podcast, David Willetts, you know, under the coalition government, and then the current science minister as well, if I can embarrass Steele a little bit. So that's one thing which I think is going to be good. The second thing is around finance as well. So again, if we think that these intangibles are getting more important, what we talk about in the book, and you know, we alluded to a little bit earlier on, is if these intangibles are sunk, it's going to be very difficult for banks to lend against them.
Yeah.
So the thing that every entrepreneur knows, if they go to the bank with their house, a very tangible asset, they're going to get a loan.
Yeah.
If they go to the bank with a brilliant new design or a fantastic app or some idea for some music or something, it's very, very hard to get a loan. So some kind of reforms around a financial structure which is excessively orientated to financing against tangible assets, I think, you know, again, seems to me to be a clear way forward.
And on that, Charlie, the finance, does that mean we need new financial institutions, or do the existing financial institutions have to evolve? You know, it's that always question as to whether, you know, we get the innovation by, you know, new entrants versus incumbents changing. I mean, maybe that's that's not the right question to ask, but I'm just curious in your thinking on that.
So, short answer is you will need institutional change.
Yeah.
So it's interesting when you talk to people who have been in the markets. Let me take a step back. One big issue that we have in the financial system as a whole is that debt finance has a big tax advantage over equity finance because debt interest is tax deductible, and it's long been a kind of a goal of people who look at the economics of the tax system to try and equalise that. It was in the big Mermes review, taxation. When you then talk to people who are actually involved on a day-to-day basis in business finance, what they will say is, okay, if you can achieve the Herculean political effort of equalising the tax treatment, there will also need to be a lot of institutional change and cultural change. Because, for example, banks, as well as being kind of economic actors, are institutions.
Yeah.
They have ways of lending. British banks have particular ways of lending. German banks have different ways. But if you want to get to a situation where more, particularly small and medium-sized companies, had equity from outside investors, you would need analysis, you need mechanisms for delivering it, you need loan officers or finance officers who knew how to do that. So this is kind of a big change, as you say in the book. Now, it's kind of an important change, but it means it's not just kind of a line item in a future budget, but a lot of other things will need to happen.
Yeah.
And I guess there's the cultural issue as well, which different people argue about how big it is, but you know, it is believed that a lot of small business people in the UK are very reluctant to give up equity for reasons of control.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of need, this would be the kind of change that, as well as making the legal change and the institutional change, there'd probably also be quite a long period of bedding in to make this useful.
Yeah.
So institutions matter.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right about this entry issue. So, for example, the Competition Commission has done a long inquiry.
Yeah.
Into banks, this age-old problem about, you know, what are we going to do about the position of banks supplying small businesses and customers not switching and all that kind of thing. And what you find is that if you want to, as the Competition Markets Authority rightly wanted to, if you wanted to encourage entry, it turns out the devil is in the details. So entry is amazingly relatively easy in some respects for new banks, because the legacy banks, and anyone who's been to a legacy bank would know, is riddled with incredibly unwieldy software, which has been through many, many generations, and one bit of software won't talk to the other bit of software and all that kind of stuff, whereas the new entrants potentially could just do it on one bit of software. But of course, the financing rules and regulations for new entrants are often very unsympathetic to these new entrants. So there's a lot of, you know, really nitty-gritty detailed work that probably needs to be done around getting the regulation right so that the new entrants can come in and then they can start financing these intangible rich companies in ways that, you know, we haven't even thought of yet.
Right.
That's the whole miracle of what we hope the competitive market would achieve.
Yeah.
Stuff that's not in our book, some smart entrepreneur, much smarter than us, will think of. If they, as long as they have the opportunity to have a go, then that should help us.
And so, I mean, those are two good examples I get. I would think of those as, you know, national policy levers, and then they, you know, they play out differently across, you know, different firms and different places. What are your thoughts, you know, given the, you know, the nature of the book about where, you know, the local policy space is or could be? I mean, planning maybe one, say something a little bit about that. But your thoughts around, you know, that balance between what we need to get right at national and then what can localities, you know, groupings of city regions and, you know, metro mayors and, you know, all of that sort of stuff, what can they be doing?
Well, I mean, you know, we've, having just been speaking a lot about national things, we think there's a huge role for city leaders and for local government here, because, as we were saying earlier, a big fact of the intangible economy is that spillovers and synergies really matter. And, you know, for the time being, these spillovers tend to happen face-to-face in places.
Absolutely.
So the role of placemaking, the role of urbanism, we would believe would be more important in an intangible economy than a tangible economy. So this is kind of a moment for the kind of people who listen to this podcast to kind of really take the stage when it comes to managing the economy. I think part of the issue there is that so many of the solutions that are required here are very place specific. If we're talking about how to make a place where people will meet together, will work effectively together, those answers are all going to be quite specific to an individual place, and that makes sense for it to be something to be devolved.
Well, I think this is interesting. One of the things you were talking about, alluding to, in the book, and as we talked about earlier on, you know, you said about, you know, housing and workspace being kind of critical elements, components of, you know, how a place can, you know, provide conditions. But you also talked about, you know, the music venues, the artistic spaces and places, you know, the creativity side, which is very the Jane Jacobs model of, you know, mixed use neighbourhoods where, you know, you're combining and recombining old with new and new with new. And it's a kind of interesting
Hiding behind this as well, of course, and we have a chapter on this, is there something around infrastructure?
Yeah.
And in particular around e-infrastructure. And there does seem to me to be a very active debate about whether the state of our broadband and 3G is fit for purpose because of the rather peculiar industrial structure around, you know, BT owning you know the broadband network and the phone network and all that kind of thing. That may be an area where we could think hard about the industrial structure, but also maybe we could let different regions have a go. If one region wants to have super fast, ultra fast broadband in its region, maybe it should have a try. See if it gets somebody else instead of the incumbent. See if that helps the benefit. Obviously, you'd have to work out the interconnection issues, but that's something we could do.
Yeah,
that may be an area of where local policy really might do some good.
And I guess thinking a little blue skies here, we've so far made this assumption, which is true at the moment, that these spillovers and synergies, all these connections, happen largely face to face. Now, obviously, for several decades now, people have been prophesying this thing called the death of distance. Which, you know, distance has stayed resolutely alive. But of course, that might not always be the case.
No.
And there are some things that have, where distance has died. You know, some aspects of globalised manufacture, obviously, where now supply chains are extremely attenuated. Now, there's kind of an interesting question there from a local government point of view about, well, who might have an interest in trying to solve this problem, or to put it a different way, who might want to get some of the benefits of the intangibles where there won't be these physical agglomerations of people. So, you know, if you are Highlands and Islands Enterprise, for example, or a council with a rural lookout, there's a question of, are there some interesting experiments to be done using, as Jonathan said, new technologies, ways of networking people that don't depend on proximity? And, you know, it was now kind of, well, nearly 50 years ago, possibly more than 50 years ago, that some of these communication technologies were first tested, you know, the first video conference.
Absolutely.
This kind of DARPA-funded research into how to bring people together. Gradually, those are being more deployed, and, you know, we know from the history of things like electrification, it does take decades for people to work out how to use these technologies.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I were sponsoring government research or looking at this from a local government point of view, I would put a little bit of time into investing in this question of the death of distance, even though it's been sort of much overhyped for the last kind of 30 years.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I'm always struck by, you know, many of the conversations I have about, you know, in relation to cities and rural areas, is that rural areas are trying to talk about things like that as if they were cities, rather than actually kind of being really clear about, clearly rural is not urban, and, you know, it's not a replication of we want a bit of what you've got. It's actually the mix that you may require, the priorities you may need to focus on will be, you know, will expectedly be different from what we see in urban. The policy levers are as well. But I think the other interesting point you touch on in the book you just made there is, I think there is an increasing recognition we need to think about, you know, particularly in urban areas, about the production and the consumption side. You know, what we've seen, and you talk about this because of the nature of the space, but actually what we see is people wanting to, you know, are huge value from producing in cities face to face, but actually increasingly lots of value on the, you know, on the consumption side, the kind of living element. Not for everybody, obviously, you know, this always appeals to more cohorts than some cohorts more than others, but I think that's an interesting one around the consumption side as well. As we kind of come to a close, I say a little bit more about your thinking about education, and particularly adult education. I was heartened deeply to, you know, for you to pick out that and focus on that. Not that I wouldn't expect you to, but, you know, as you say, it gets overlooked so often, the adult education, particularly non-FE adult education. I think it's a critical issue. I think it's a critical issue for dealing with some of our left behind places. I think there's something to be, you know, to be done there in those sorts of places that gives a much more prominence to, you know, ongoing adult education away from the classic university. But just say more about where you are on, you know, how you got to that and what your thinking is on that.
Well, let me say a bit of background, and then maybe Steve wants to come in on sort of specifics about adult education. You might, and many, especially, you know, when we've done this book at schools, people have said to us, well, tell us some careers advice. You're telling us the economy is changing.
Yeah.
School kids say, what should we do? And you might think that our advice would be, since we think the economy is doing more R&D, you know, you should be a really good scientist. Or we think the economy is doing more software, you should be a really good computer programmer, best Python programmer. In other words, you might think the advice would be the best of each of these kind of intangible, the best designer or something like that. And that's true. There's going to be one person who's going to be a J.K. Rowling, and there's people who are going to be really good Python programmers. But we think, actually, this is the point, that because of the synergies that Steve was talking about earlier on, actually, a really valuable skill in the future is going to be bringing all of these bundles of intangible assets together, being able to coordinate people who are the best programmer and the best designer and the best scientist and all of that. And it's not clear that those types of skills of coordination and management and recognising the potential of bringing all this stuff together, it's not clear that those types of skills are the traditional skills that we teach in university.
No.
It's not clear that those are necessarily STEM skills. People thought we must have more STEM and we mustn't have any history and classics and all that kind of thing. Maybe these types of skills are actually go across the board, and maybe in many of the, you know, what are now perceived to be more artistic and all that kind of thing, maybe those types of skills might flourish there. So
yeah.
I think as a bit of background,
yeah.
when we think about adult education in particular, we mustn't go down the trap of thinking it's got to be either STEM or not STEM.
Yeah.
We've got to have no more poetry, but lots more Python programming.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the background points that
yeah.
you make.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. And if we think about adult education in that context, it's kind of the fact that it provides flexibility is the crucial thing. I think, you know, there is a big risk whenever anyone talks about the future
yeah.
in the context
yeah.
of education
yeah.
that people fetishize technology and fetishize the skills required for technology, which is certainly not unimportant, but you know, if you have an economy with spillovers and with synergies, then this will not be an economy where it's lots of people sitting in isolated cubicles tapping into computers. There
yeah.
will be real, real importance to synthesis as well.
Yeah,
but also there's the opportunity for technology to help in the whole education
yeah,
process.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a university lecturer. If you think about what our, if I may call it this, business model is in universities,
yeah.
it's pretty much the same as it's been for
yeah.
about 800 years,
absolutely.
Which is that there's me at the
yeah.
front, and there's a whole load of students, you know, sitting there listening to me for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And it's just appalling that in the era of information technology, we're still in too many universities, with the exception of Imperial College, of course, I should say.
Yes.
It's appalling that we're still using exactly that same technology. So I think part of what we've got to talk about on adult education is the possibility of kind of using new technologies in much more imaginative ways to get some much better educational outcomes.
Yeah, and I thought that bit was particularly interesting. Mirrors, you know, some of the conversation I've heard about, you know, in the American system, similarly about how, you know, if you look at universities today, they look pretty much like they were, you know, 200 or 300 years ago, and actually, you know, some more innovation around how you deliver these sorts of certain courses, irrespective of almost of what the course is, I think is kind of interesting area. Final thoughts on two areas. Final thoughts. How do you see this the whole area? I mean, it's a big question around, you know, how does this evolve? You know, is it evolution
mm-hmm.
rather than kind of revolution? I suppose on the one hand, and then. In the book, you set out these two stylized countries, one being, we've got it, we've nailed it, one not nailing it, they haven't got it. Where do we look for countries, I suppose, that are closer to, you know, they are grappling with and are making progress against the ones that maybe
mm.
are not? So evolution, revolution, and then where should we look?
So shall I try a couple of stats
yeah, go
on the evolution? So two particular aspects of this. One is, we talked about measurement earlier on.
Yeah.
I know this is all terribly sober and a little bit arcane, but I think increasingly we're getting a lot of buy-in, gratifyingly from the book as well, from very forward-looking statistics agencies and from the accountancy profession as well, about kind of measuring all of this stuff and doing a much better job of all of that. That's one thing. The second thing is, of course, it might be that actually we've understated this intangible asset notion and its potential economic power.
Mm.
I am struck by, if you talk to the new technology kind of machine learning people, I'm very struck by, they tell you the same story, which is that machine learning was really, really hard. It's been really difficult to get translations going and voice recognition and recognizing cats and tables and all that kind of thing. But, they all say, in the last 18 months, that has completely changed. There's been a total step change in all of that. So this is a little bit speculative, and I haven't tried this on my co-author who may disagree with me, but if we think about the future, maybe we're actually at a time, if these machine learning people are right, that at least in that particular area, there might be even more profound change.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So just to build on that, I think that's a very good point, but something that someone pointed out to me yesterday,
right.
Pointed out to me by Juan Mateus Garcia, a very large-brained former colleague of mine at Nest.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we were talking about the fact that if you want to make the most of an intangible economy, you need to somehow fix or resolve the contestedness, the fact that it's hard to know who owns assets, how they're exchanged, and to sort of make that process work better. And Juan pointed out on Twitter, very helpfully, that this could be something that you could do with blockchain. And specifically, he was sort of saying one of the reasons why blockchain is so exciting, or arguably the primary reason, not anything to do with cryptocurrencies, is that it basically allows you to somewhat parsimoniously work out the various claims to these assets and log them and so forth. And I thought that was fascinating. And I'm someone who, we'll keep this a secret between us and all the people listening on the podcast. I'm someone who finds blockchain very hard to understand, and I've found the hype behind blockchain very hard to understand. But when Juan made this point to me, I was like, oh, goodness me, this is an enormous use case and helped me to make sense of a lot of the marketing behind blockchain that clever people like Vinay Gupta, who are blockchain experts, had been sort of pointing out, but it hadn't quite clicked to me. So I suddenly thought, oh, well, there's another, alongside machine learning, there is another potential technology that might take the intangible economy, you know, we draw this kind of steady, nice upward sloping line of how it's progressing, but that might kind of cause it to jump up. So, there could be some exciting developments in that area.
And thinking about places we can look for inspiration and, you know, insight as to how we make more of it. You know, from a UK point of view, wanted to make more of this, make it, you know, create more prosperous areas, the more prosperous economy. Who's doing it better than others?
So I think there are a lot of places that are pretty well documented case studies of good innovation economies, whether those are specific clusters like Silicon Valley or Pittsburgh or Cambridge, or countries like Israel, Singapore, and so forth. I think one kind of interesting approach from a policy-making point of view is the example of what Ireland did in the 1990s and 2000s. And I think it's interesting because it was so programmatic.
Yeah.
They had a goal and they set out to do it.
Yeah.
And some of that was kind of very much about attracting FDI in intangible intensive industries. And, you know, they played the angles very hard, you know, from a tax point of view, from a skills point of view. But some of it was kind of quite traditional industrial policy, but just updated for a more intangible era. So, for example, the Irish call centre strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't think of call centres necessarily as being a kind of glamorous industry you want to attract. But actually, call centres employ a million people in the UK, so they're important. But if you look at call centres in Ireland, they tend to be very highly value-added jobs and quite well-paid jobs and quite rewarding. So, for example, Microsoft technical support that happens in a call centre. It's technically a call centre job, but it's a high, you know, you need to be a pretty skilled person on a relatively good wage to be providing that.
Mm.
And European Microsoft technical support happens in Ireland. And they spent a lot of time planning their skills strategy, their land use strategy to attract these businesses and to get them to develop themselves. So they kind of did a bunch of quite sort of piratical attracting businesses in, and then a bunch of very careful long-term skills development and business university link policy. So I've got a soft spot for the Irish example.
Very good. Jonathan, where would you suggest if we were looking, what would be who would be at the top of your list?
I would hope, but I mean, this reflects my background, that something about, you know, a well-funded and outward-looking science base will be a very sort of fecund area for new ideas, be they blockchain, be they around machine learning, be they around, you know, biotech and health and all that kind of stuff. So I would hope that would bear fruit.
Excellent. My guests today have been Jonathan Haskell and Stephen Westlake, and I encourage everybody to buy the book and read it. It's fantastic. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities.
You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.